As we've been seeing all this week, the sinking of the Titanic continues to capture the public's imagination even a century after the event. As one historian put it, the three most written about subjects of all time are Jesus, the Civil War, and the Titanic. Writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn, who is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and to the New York Review of Books, has written an article for the April 16th issue of The New Yorker that explores our enduring fascination with the catastrophe. It's called Unsinkable: Why We Can't Let Go of the Titanic. His new collection of essays, Waiting for the Barbarians, will be published in August. And I'm very pleased to welcome Daniel Mendelsohn back to our show. Hello.
Hi, nice to be back.
This week, a number of people are taking a Titanic Memorial cruise, but I've yet to see ads for a Lusitania Memorial cruise or a Hindenburg Memorial Zeppelin flight. Right. Why is the Titanic remembered in a way that other disasters are not?
Well, in so many ways, you know, it seems to be a symbol of just about everything. It's one of the most convenient symbols. You know, there's a great, it seems to combine a lot of irresistible themes. So, for example, class, you know, the survival rate of first-class men was roughly equal to that of third-class children. So it's a sort of parable about class injustice. There's a lot of glamour. It seems to be about the twilight of the Edwardian age. It's a kind of, some people see it as a forecast of World War I and the end, essentially, of the 19th century and its prejudices and privileges. So there's all that. It's always seemed to be irresistibly about a lot of things.
And you say it properly belongs in the realm of myth. Walter Lord, who wrote one of the best-selling books on the subject, A Night to Remember, called the sinking a classic Greek tragedy. Do you know what he meant by that?
Well, I do. You know, I do, because I'm a classicist, so it's kind of irresistibly. It's a comment that Lord made that caught my attention long ago. And I mean, I think that really, when you look at the Titanic, the sort of structure of the story, it combines two irresistible models about how we think about tragic events, which are actually embedded in Greek tragedy, which is our oldest model for thinking about bad events. And those are, you know, on the one hand, the ship itself is a female, right? Ships are girls, basically. And this ship is forced to go too fast in dangerous conditions, and so it's sort of in order to win prizes and get attention, and so it's a sort of sacrificial virgin, so to speak. And then there's also a kind of tragic model about a wonderful, self-sufficient, glamorous hero, you know, a sort of Oedipus character, who you construct a drama around about how this person falls apart, basically, in front of your very eyes.
And it reminds us of the Greek word hubris, doesn't it? We've been speaking about the Titanic all this week. There's been so much written about it. And Daniel Mendelsohn has written an article about why so much has been written about it. It's in the current issue of The New Yorker, the April 16th issue, under the title Unsinkable: Why We Can't Let Go of the Titanic. Do you think that most of the angles have been exhausted by now?
Well, I don't. You know, it seems to be metaphorical. You know, I talk about this hilarious headline that the satirical newspaper, The Onion, ran years ago, running a picture of the Titanic. It says, "World's largest metaphor sinks." And, you know, there is this sense about the Titanic, because it seems to be about so many things, that we'll never be able to let go of it, because it's essentially, you know, it functions in our culture the way that great literary works do. They seem to be inexhaustible because they seem eternally to be about important issues. And I don't think we're going to let go of it because, you know, when the Titanic, when you look at the history of the Titanic throughout the past 100 years, this is the 100th anniversary, you know, it was used by the anti-suffragettes. It was used by the labor movement as a symbol of their struggles. You know, everybody finds in this event a convenient symbol. And I think for that reason, it will never stop being useful any more than certain great works of literature never stop being useful. You know, it's just good to think about.
How did the anti-suffragettes use it as a symbol?
Well, it's actually very funny because, you know, as we know, there was a sort of rule of the sea that women and children should be first off the ship in a case of an emergency, and this has become a kind of a slogan that represents the gender biases of the time: ladies first, children first. And at the time, in the teens and 20s, anti-suffragette speakers would say, well, are you sure you want equal rights? Because after all, then you won't be able to be first into the lifeboat, you know. So that became a kind of a way to use the Titanic in the service of a political cause.
Now, were a disproportionate number of the survivors women and children?
Actually, I think there were. I don't think it was actually as disproportionate as one would imagine, given the women and children first motto of the time. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but when they were revealed during the, there was a Senate investigation immediately afterwards, and there was also a British Board of Trade investigation into the disaster, and they revealed some pretty startling results, the most famous of which was that the class played, in fact, an important role in who survived. And if the higher up you were in the class system, the better a chance that you had in surviving. And that was a sort of a wake-up call in many ways. And the class issue has resounded, particularly in film adaptations, for example. It's something that directors and writers love to emphasize.
In fact, in the James Cameron film, people in steerage were not saved. But yesterday we spoke to Christine Quinn, whose grandmother was in steerage, one of the Irish immigrants in steerage. And she did escape, one of 40 who did. So some of the myths just don't pan out to be true.
Right. Although it is true that, sure, there were people in third class who survived, but there is, all accounts make it very clear that the manner in which people were helped off the ship, let's say, was a lot more refined and organized in the case of first-class passengers than it was in the case of steerage passengers. And, you know, one thing that the Cameron film gets right is that steerage passengers were really kept behind locked iron gates, while the other passengers were helped off the boat deck into the lifeboats. And finally, more or less immediately before the ship actually foundered, steerage passengers got through. So a lot of the myths are myths because they're true also.
Well, this does seem to be somewhat a matter of fact following fiction. There was a novel called Futility that seems very similar to the disaster, and it was written in 1898, 14 years before the Titanic sunk.
Right.
So how close does it come to describing what actually happened?
Well, it is uncanny, and all of us Titanic enthusiasts, it's one of our favorite articles of Titanic trivia. There was this guy called Morgan Robertson who wrote a novel in 1898 about a great ship that during a course of a transatlantic voyage hits an iceberg and founders. And what's uncanny is the description of this ship in 1898 in many ways almost exactly matches the actual Titanic, in the number of propellers it had, and it's more or less, it's in the right neighborhood of how big it was, its tonnage. So it's a sort of creepy forecast. The most startling thing, aside from hitting the iceberg and foundering, is that the name of the fictional ship is the Titan. So, you know, but this goes to the point I was making earlier, that there's something about this story that it seems it's so ripe as material for a work of literature that, in fact, it was a work of literature before it even happened, because the themes are so irresistibly literary. It's about hubris, right? Man builds a ship that is supposed to be unsinkable, because in the novel, as in real life, there were people who were claiming this was an unsinkable ship because of its advanced design. So, of course, as soon as you build the ship that you say is unsinkable and God himself could not sink it, of course it's going to sink. And that's a literary idea that just happened, as you say, fact followed literature in this case.
Hasn't one of your themes been about nostalgia for the past? I mean, at one point in your mid-teens, you worked on a novel set on the Titanic. And more recently, I read your analysis of Mad Men, mm-hmm. which kind of dissected that show in a way that its fans might be made a little uneasy to read.
Yes, but I think, you know, the point of my essay about Mad Men was just that I believe that what really motivates the popularity of this, and I myself included myself in this group of people who found something strangely alluring about the TV series, is nostalgia. You know, it brings you back to a moment about which you have very strong sentiments. And in that sense also, I mean, you're right to make the connection. You know, in that sense also, the Titanic is a great vehicle for nostalgia. You know, we love to think that there was an earlier time in which people acted with greater chivalry and savoir-faire and courtesy. And, you know, a lot of the stories that came out of the Titanic are really wonderful examples of a kind of panache. You know, these, for example, Benjamin Guggenheim, the philanthropist and millionaire who was one of the casualties of the Titanic, famously told somebody that if he was going to go down, he was going to go down like a gentleman. He changed out of his into white tie and tails in order to go down like a gentleman. And there's the story of Mrs. Strauss, the wife of the founder of Macy's, who refused to leave her husband. And so we project onto the Titanic so many notions that we have of how much lovelier the past was, you know. And that, of course, is also can be a false sentiment, because whatever Benjamin Guggenheim was doing was very nice and had a lot of panache. But, of course, as we know, there were third-class children who were not being allowed onto lifeboats. So one has to take all this with a grain of salt. But it is a kind of a screen onto which we project our own nostalgia.
And few of us today have white tails. If we own a tuxedo at all, it's going to be your standard issue tuxedo to go to a black tie affair once in a while. But this is really morbid stuff, people freezing to death in the water. And I wonder whether you think there might be something of a rubbernecking phenomenon going on here as well. Does the disaster raise questions of what we would have done unless we were helplessly attached to a pipe like Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah, right, exactly. As if there weren't enough going on, he has to be handcuffed to a pipe. Yeah, I do think that there is the rubbernecking phenomenon. Look, any, let's say, civilian disaster, any kind of large loss of life that is not the result of a wartime violence is deeply fascinating to us. And, you know, one also has to remember, and I think this is very hard for us today, that in 1912, there was only one way for people to travel to Europe, and that was in large ships. So originally, a lot of the rubbernecking aspect of the allure was, in some sense, very similar to what we experience when we read, for example, about plane crashes. You know, we don't go in boats anymore, large ships, except for fun, basically. But, you know, if one needed to travel, this is how you do it. So there was an extra element of, say, reality that we don't experience when we think about the Titanic, which is you had to go on these things, and when they foundered, it was really scary to think that these giant ships would seem so safe and well-designed and unsinkable actually go down. And yes, a large loss of life is sort of ghoulishly interesting to people. And, you know, there's a whole kind of other part of the Titanic mystique or story, which has to do, for example, with the recovery of the bodies, which were floating around for years, some of them, and were picked up by ships traveling in those sea lanes. 3 years later, I think a lifeboat was found with three bodies in it, one of them still wearing a tuxedo. So, yes, there's a ghoulish kind of macabre aspect to this.
My guest is writer and critic Daniel Mendelsohn, who is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books. And he has a new collection of essays, which will not include, I suspect, any writing about the Titanic, called Waiting for the Barbarians.
But it will.
It will.
Yeah, I think this essay is going to be in it, actually.
And it's going to be published in August by whom?
By New York Review Books.
And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that it was the only way to travel to Europe, to go in one of these ships, although you could probably have gone on a freighter. But do you think the Titanic revealed our insecurities about technology or helped create them?
Well, sure. I mean, that's another, I mean, you're right to bring this up, because another theme, let's say, of this strangely literary kind of story is man against nature. And at the time it was built, the Titanic had the most advanced technological apparatus, both in terms of how it was powered, in terms of its safety, believe it or not. It had a double hull construction, which is why even in a technical magazine it was described as being virtually unthinkable. And so, you know, you can look at it, and people certainly have, as the culmination of the 19th century belief in technology. When you think of the 19th century and these extraordinary technological advances and the Industrial Revolution at the beginning, and telegraph and telephones and all of, you know, cameras. And so there was a tremendous confidence by the end of the 19th century when essentially the Titanic first went off as a light bulb in somebody's head. In the early 20th century, people had an idea for a supersized class of advanced ships. And so in that sense, by all means, you know, the idea that this technology could fail so catastrophically, and I think this is a very important part of the mystique, on the first time it sailed, you know, I think the fact that it was a maiden voyage is so shocking because, you know, you put this thing in the water and it doesn't even get across the ocean.
Is that one of the reasons you think that this sticks in the public's imagination more than the sinking of Lusitania, which is tragic in another way? It was sunk by a German U-boat.
Right, right.
It had just as much of a glamorous passenger list, and it's equally tragic.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and I wrote about this in my article this week, that the fact that it's the maiden voyage creates this irresistible allure. You know, I always say if the Titanic had sunk on its 27th voyage, we wouldn't be thinking about it so much. But the idea of this never-to-be-completed voyage is so tantalizing to us. And I think you're right, the Lusitania, also loaded with celebrities, Vanderbilts, and I can't remember who else was on it, it functions very differently in the imagination because, as I said before, that was a wartime disaster. So already the circumstances are different. There were U-boats out there targeting commercial shipping already by 1915. It went down very quickly. The Lusitania, I believe, sank in like 18 minutes. Mm-hmm. Because of this giant explosion triggered by this torpedo. And so, you know, one of the interesting things about Titanic is that it sank in 2 hours and 40 minutes, which is to say it had a lot of time to generate stories, you know, things that people did, people remembered, dramas, farewells. You know, there was time to have a little bit of a story. Lusitania, you're right, is very different.
Now, one of the early films called Save from the Titanic included Dorothy Gibson, who survived the shipwreck. Was that seen as a casting coup at the time? It strikes me as a bit ghoulish.
Yes, you're right. There was an actress, a film star aboard the Titanic called Dorothy Gibson, and within a month after the sinking in the spring of 1912, somebody had rushed into production a one-reeler called Save from the Titanic, in which she starred as a passenger aboard the doomed ship. I think of it as the first reality show, personally. But yeah, there was something sort of ghoulish, but there was also, I think what one has to remember is an immense hunger right at the moment, because these Senate investigations were going on. It was this immense news story. It's one of the first global giant news stories. There was a tremendous hunger for anything, and I think whoever made this movie knew what they were doing.
And then there have been other movies up until recently. One of the biggest grossing movies of all time. There was a Barbara Stanwyck film, some others, and there was the film of A Night to Remember. And then there was a Broadway musical in 1997.
Indeed.
They often have a love story in the middle. Is that a way to add an additional layer of drama to something that's already full of a lot of material to work with?
Well, sure. I mean, we love our human interest stories. And, you know, especially for the purposes of popular entertainment, it's always an aspect. You know, it's there were real love stories aboard the Titanic, as we know, like Mr. and Mrs. Strauss, which is so eloquent. But, of course, if you have Barbara Stanwyck in a movie in 1953, you want her to be emoting. And so, you know, the Titanic generally has been the subject of a kind of film in which there are two strands. And one is the sentimental drama, right? Families being torn apart, wives giving up their lives for husbands, or as we know from Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, young love sundered forever. It heightens the drama, but there's also the other strand, which is just the drama of watching this incredibly wonderful object disintegrate before your eyes.
Now, in working on this article, you did a fair amount of research. Mm-hmm. Anything surprise you?
Well, I've been a Titanic enthusiast since I was a little kid, but there's always more. What surprises me is that I think there are 36 titles being published this spring for the centenary, and that's surprising. There's always something new to be said. There's a very good little book by John Maxton Graham about the role of wireless communication. You know, it's the legend has it that the first SOS ever sent out was by the Titanic, although that's now disputed. But it's a story in which wireless Marconi radio played an incredibly crucial role. So there's that. You know, everyone has a different angle, and there's always something new.
And what about your novel that you wrote when you were in your teens? What happened to that?
Luckily, well, I know it's not destroyed because I went into my closet the other day and dug it out, but it's so terrible that I'm happy to say it will never see the light of day until I'm dead, I hope.
And nothing in it is of any value? You didn't at least think at one point, gee, that was pretty good.
No, I don't think that. But what's interesting is that, you know, we were just talking about the way these things become movies, and that even without having seen any of the movies at the age of 12 or 14, whenever I was writing this, I instantly understood that there had to be the human interest angle. So I understood I was writing a novel about two boys who make friends aboard the boat, and of course one of them is going to drown and the other not. And that's basically the story of every Titanic movie ever since.
Daniel Mendelsohn's article in the April 16th issue of The New Yorker is Unsinkable, Why We Can't Let Go of the Titanic. And we'll also be able to read that essay expanded or pretty much the same thing?
Pretty much the same, I think.
Waiting for the Barbarians, his next book, which will be published in August. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks. Always great to be with you.